across the UK, across continental North America, and around the world on the internet by webcast and by podcast. My name is Howard Hughes. This is The Unexplained. I'm not going to say too much here at the introduction because we have a lot to do. Paul Sinclair, special guest on this edition, kind of end of year roundup, a big one with Paul on this edition. Always love having Paul on here. The conversation, as you will hear, just flows every time we do this. Nice and sunny, not quite too cold, so that's good. Thank you very much for all of your good wishes for my sister, who is now recovering. She will need some surgery at a future date. And that's how we left that. But I had to get to Worcester quickly to be with her. And, you know, I'm glad that things are resolving themselves. I have some issues with myself that I'm going to have to deal with that might mean that I may have to take a little bit of time away from things just to get them sorted. One of the things my sister, who's very wise, when she came home from the hospital, said to me is that you've got to give yourself some time. And, you know, I guess I have to. Maybe that goes for all of us. You know, life is pressured these days, isn't it? Everybody's being pulled here, there and everywhere. But let me just say this about my sister. I'd like to thank all of the hospital staff. Under a lot of pressure, with a lot of people to deal with, my sister first took ill at the beginning of a weekend, and weekends are difficult for the health service. You know, resources are stretched. And they did a marvellous job with her. They did everything that they needed to do. They did it quickly, and we knew where we stood quickly. And that's a marvellous thing, so thank you for that. Okay, no more to say, really. Thank you to Adam for getting the shows out to you. Thank you to you if you want to make contact with me. The website is theunexplained.tv. You can email me from there. And my Facebook page is the official Facebook page of The Unexplained with Howard Hughes. Tried an experiment with this edition. We're going to see how it goes. On Facebook, just before I started recording, I went on and I said, I'm doing a podcast with Paul Sinclair. Do you have any questions? And I can see here that they are coming in. Amazingly, thank you so much for that. Don't think I've got any more to say, really. You know, life goes on, as they say. So I hope everything is okay with you. Don't get too stressed with the Christmas planning, will you? Because, you know, it'll all be over before you know it. And, you know, my parents used to get really stressed and sometimes argue on Christmas Eve. And, you know, the day passes. It always does, like every other day. But, you know, I hope you have a nice one. Okay, let's get to Yorkshire now, to my good friend Paul Sinclair. Nice to have you back on. How's life, Paul?
Life's okay, thank you, Howard. A bit hectic, but I think we can all say the same, really, can't we?
Well, I think we probably can. And, you know, we could have a long conversation about that. But I think our listeners might be a little bit bored with it. But it's been a weird year. My friends who do astrology, and that includes my big sister, they say that this has been a real challenging year. I know some people don't believe in astrology, and I understand that. I'm on the fence about it, but apparently this has been a real challenging year. And if you thought that it was going to end quietly, don't think so. So I think a lot of people are going through it right now. I definitely am in so many ways. And you're going through it too. I just think there's something happening to the world. And I can't work out what it might be. This is not the place or time, but you know what I'm saying.
No, you're spot on. It probably isn't, but you're absolutely right in what you're saying. It's the speed of things. Everything's going so fast and everybody's under so much pressure to get things done even faster. And then there's all the troubles. So, you know, maybe The Unexplained is a release from all of that.
Well, I think it might be a release, but I think also at times we're on the cusp of an explanation. And that's one of the reasons, as an old newsman, that I continue to do and be interested in a show like this, because I think the news and the run of events that we see don't explain things to people. They just encourage people to bury their heads in their phone and not think about and look at what's going on. But anyway, don't get me started, Paul, and we've got lots to talk about. Now, I'll tell you something that's going to gladden your heart. I did a little experiment. You know, I've had a lot to do, as my social media consumers will know. I've had some challenges, you know, of various kinds lately. I won't bother going into those, but I didn't have time to put out an appeal on my social media for, you know, if you've got any questions for Paul Sinclair, let me know. So 10 minutes ago, it's now 15 minutes ago, I asked on my social media, and I've now got so far around about 20 questions for you after 15 minutes. And that's astonishing when that only went out on Facebook, and that just goes to show the pull that you've got and the fact that I've got eyes on my social media. It's amazing. So we better crack on, I think. I think we have a responsibility. Talk to me first then, Paul, because we last spoke at any length in February, I think, this year. I don't know where the year went. About what this year has been like. Not the specific cases, but the sorts of things that have been coming into you.
Well, much of the same, Howard, and I've been doing the things that I usually do, probably even more so, and get into these locations. The cases that have been coming in, I've had a few really unusual ones. And there's been things coming in, and I realise a lot of listeners won't know where the Lynx golf course is on the edge of Bridlington. There's been a few reports coming in, and however historic these reports may be, I always think if I've never heard them before, your listeners have never heard them before, then they're just as valid, and it shows the significance of certain landmark locations within the area. And as we've said many times, you know, these locations are all over the place. Perhaps, I'm only saying perhaps here, it's the fact that I've got all this time to devote, it's pretty much 24/7, that I'm picking these out and I'm running with them. And there's probably other locations where, myself included, 10, 15 years ago, I wouldn't have been able to do that. So there's equally good researchers in other areas picking up cases, but not highlighting the significance and the prolific amount of reports that are actually in their areas. So I don't really think I'm in a particularly avid hotspot. I just think it's the fact that I'm running with a lot of cases and a lot of reports, and it's making it look like there's tons happening, which there is. But I still think that there's lots of other locations around the UK, around the world, that are producing what we'll call the events of high strangeness.
I'm looking at page 34 of Truth Proof 2, which I was going through this morning. I've got the books. You know, I get sent an awful lot of books, and I only have a tiny little flat. So I can't keep them all, unfortunately. But I have kept yours, and they're in my bookcase. And I'm just looking at... I've got pile up here behind me with my cup of coffee. Truth Proof 3, Truth Proof 4, and Truth Proof 2. Truth Proof 2, page 34, you say this, and you're talking about Bempton and the cliffs here. Without doubt, I think something about this area makes it suitable for producing strange phenomena. Only a lack of suitable explanations or the right words prevents our understanding of them. Lovely sentence. But this place and others in the world just like it are where we should be focusing our research. As always, you say, I think location is key. Says it all.
Absolutely. Yeah, and location is key, and there are locations within the zone of strangeness that are even stronger. And obviously, we're constantly... all we've got are words to describe what people are seeing, describe what people are experiencing, Howard. But, you know, we're maybe going to have to invent new words for different types of phenomena that are presenting. But... you know, there's a particular area, at Bempton, I was going to say close to Bempton. It's actually close to the old RAF base, RAF Bempton, that first came to the area. The RAF came in 1940, and they vacated about 1970. And there's a hill there, and it's just produced so much in the way of the unexplained over the years, and not just sightings by myself, and I will say my team of people, or our team of people, because now, I mean, I've been up there, four times this week already, and I'll probably go tonight. You'll chuckle, people. It probably stops me eating crisps and nibbling on a night.
So gets you out the house.
Yeah, so I'll be up there tonight, but this particular hill... or it looks like a hill from the cliff top. When you actually get to the, we'll call it the summit, it levels back onto sort of flat land and farmland beyond. But there's been so much stuff seen up there. And it's almost hidden in plain sight kind of information, because even in the first and second book, I'd got people talking about that there's a guy called David Ellis who lived in Bempton. And I think I've maybe shared this one with you before, Howard, and your listeners. But he took one summer's evening, late evening, and took his two Labrador dogs for a walk and ended up on the field below the hill. And he's watching an owl skimming about the landscape. And on the edge of the cliff, just below the hill, he sees this huge... like single-decker bus-sized bubble of mist stroke light. hanging over the cliffs and over the path, and he's observing it. It didn't seem to affect his dogs. He's observing it. When I say from a distance, we're probably talking 200 yards away, because he's gone through, parked at the RS, probably walked up the lane. I'm going to say parked, but he lived in Bempton. So he's in the RSPB car park and gone through the gate, which is now... it's not permitted for public to go on there because of the nesting birds. But back then, when David saw this, it was. And he stood in the field watching it, and it's just below this hill. Obviously, he's no attachment to the hill, and that's not referenced. I'm just noting it now. And he said inside this mist and light, this sort of cloud that's got a shape to it, you know, sort of an oval shape, but he can't see anything inside it apart from lights that are just punching out. But... that's just one account in close proximity to that hill that came to me, and I'd no thoughts on that. We've got a concentrated zone within the zone of strangeness, but when you start looking at these things, and I think it was 2018, you asked me to come onto the show, and you'd put on, like you do quite often, the guests that are coming on, and somebody contacted you. Emailed you to say that they'd seen a flash of light on the cliff tops whilst walking with two friends. And I think their walk normally took them, when they walked towards Flamborough and back, about an hour and a quarter. And when they got back to the car, basically they'd lost over an hour of time. I did get to speak to one of those witnesses. And where did they see the flash of light? Not very far from that hill. How odd. You know, I do find it fascinating. It's the same location, Howard. And I realise, people, that we're going through some of the things that I've talked about before, and I hate the thought that I'd be one of these researchers or who stands in front of an audience and just recites the same story over and over again.
There's a point there, though, Paul. People keep asking me, the thing that people ask me for most, with guests who are good guests and come back a lot, like you, they ask me for updates on things. So I don't think that's a bad thing to be able to go back to a story. Apparently, you have a new report from Hunmanby, 2011, is that right?
Yes. Would you like me to just go over that one?
For those who are new to this, because we're picking up people all the time, which is good, can you just talk to me about the Hunmanby case? It's been one of the biggest cases that you've talked about.
Yeah, the Hunmanby case, and the village name in itself is interesting, because if we break it down, it's Hund, as in hound, man, bee. And going back into ancient times, and we're not going to concentrate on the reports of the cryptids for this, but it means farmstead of the hound man, which is fascinating.
Well,
but
it kind of sounds werewolves and that sort of thing.
It really does. And then you consider, Howard, that a lot of reports, and I've done lots and lots of research into what I've called the Flixton werewolf, and that village of Flixton is 2 miles from Hunmanby. So it's fascinating. But the Hunmanby case that you're first referring to took place in 1996, 7 and 8. And that was the warehouse workers. They worked in the huge industrial unit, should I say, on the Hunmanby industrial estate. Well, back in the 1990s, there was only 5 or 6 units there. Great big sort of half brick, then steel clad buildings that you could drive a bus in or a lorry in at one end through the roller shutter doors and out the other. And over the period of June, July and August, 96, 97, 98, they experienced all manner of unexplained phenomena. It almost started almost poltergeist-like, and subtle things were happening. And the phenomena, or the intelligence that is the phenomena, it was almost amoeba-ish, and as they grew in awareness to what was happening, it was as though this intelligence grew with them, although they never got an handle on what was happening. And that story, if I'm being truthful, Howard, we could probably devote 2 hours to. But so the case that I've sort of been looking into recently is in the same village, probably about a mile away from the industrial units where those guys had their experiences, 96, 7 and 8. The closest the witness can say to a time frame is it was in between 2010 and 2012. Now, I realise this is a historic case, but I don't mind that, because you guys will have never heard it before, and until I received this information and spoke to this lady, I'd never heard this before either. She'd kept it to herself. And she told me that on the evening of 2012, it's dark and she's driving around the back of Humanby, around the back of what's called Hunmanby Hall. And then you come down a bit of a hill towards the village. This is relatively unlit. You'd only get streetlights as you get to the village. So you come to a very small roundabout. We've all seen these types of roundabouts. It's actually a circle painted in road. That's how little this roundabout is. And as they come down this unlit road, and the direction they would be taking, you would turn right to go to Bridlington or left to go into the village. And the village centre would be literally, 90 seconds away by car. That's how close they are. But there's three of them in the car. There's this lady, there's a sister, and her son. I think she said he was about 10 or 11 at the time. She said, we could see coming from the sea, then they're facing the direction of the sea, to the right and to the left. You know, we've just given those locations, but straight in front, you would be looking towards the sea, which would be 2 to 3 miles away. And they can see a huge black triangle just traveling very slowly towards them. She stops the car. There's nothing on the road, so it doesn't matter. And a sister who's in the back of the car puts the window down and sits on the ledge of the door looking up as this object passes over. And she's got a good description of it. It's so low that there's a light on each corner. And she said there's a dome-type protrusion on the top. It stops momentarily above the car. And literally, and that's what it seems to them, and then moves away at speed, and then it's gone. The next thing these three people know, including their son, they're outside the White Swan pub in the village, and over 30 minutes have passed. She's got no recollection of driving there. She almost hit a couple walking past the junction. She's at the White Swan pub, and she sort of came to, in her words, as they passed. And she came to with a start, and suddenly her son is screaming frantically in the back of the car, take me home, take me home, take me home now. And apparently he's not spoke about it, and he won't speak about it. So, you know, we're going back to potentially 2010 to 2012. So there's a lot of years passed, and this is a young man now, you know. I mean, I don't know, one day he may, it might just be too traumatic, whatever they experienced, I really don't know, but he won't speak about it. So they took him home and dropped him off at home. They then decided to go out and drive in the direction of where they saw this object departing. And something tells me, it was Wold Newton. They drove towards Wold Newton. And she said, when they're going in that direction, she could see a huge cluster of lights in a field. But they never got to the light. As much as they tried, it was such a strange night, they couldn't get to the lights. Then she rounded a corner, and as she rounded the corner, she claims that a huge white owl suddenly appeared in the windscreen of the car. She crashed the car, not crashed it in some catastrophic accident. She was that shocked. She banged the car into the verge, and she weren't very far away from a wall, she said. And after that, when they set off again, they couldn't see the lights in the field anymore. And I'm fascinated by this, not only the sighting, but the owl, the actual sighting of an owl, because there's so many reports, Howard, you know, of people seeing owls during an encounter or after.
So do you think, or we might surmise, that owls are maybe some kind of version in flesh and, you know, feathers of some other phenomenon. I'm putting this really badly, but some kind of projection. That's the word I'm looking for.
I don't think there's a good or a bad way to put it, because we don't know. All I know is that, you know, you speak to Whitley Strieber, and you'll have had him on your show, and Whitley claimed to see owls during... Or just before his encounters and around the time of the encounters. And there's the American, is it Mike Cleland? He's written books. I think one of his books is The Synchronicity of Owls and the Sightings of Owls During Events of High Strangeness. I'm not sure if I wrote about it in Night People, but I remember as a little boy, we're going back to the 1960s, you know, when these things were happening for me. I used to live at the back of these fields that were, and at the bottom of them, there was marshland that paralleled the River Don. And if there'd been any heavy rain, the Don, the river, would burst its banks and flood this swampland. And I remember looking down from my bedroom window one evening and seeing, I'm sure I wrote about this in Night People, and seeing what looked like a silver pencil over the water. That's how I described it, and that's how it looked to me. It was above the water, just slightly, and there was people. I'm not going to say alien beings or anything like that, because they were too far away, for one, and I really don't know. I just remember seeing this, but I also then I've got a memory of seeing a huge owl, huge white owl, and I could see its eyes, which are impossible. They were big amber eyes, and we used to visit my grandparents in what would be called Adwick-on-Dearne, or still is, a few times a week. And after seeing this, and I never said anything to my parents, I were avidly looking through books in my grand's home, because she were always getting Reader's Digest books, and I remember looking through the Reader's Digest book of birds, and I could see this huge snowy owl, and that was the only thing those eyes resembled. Now, is this just some overblown, not imagined thing, but I've seen an owl, and then it's just, I don't know, like Chinese whispers, it's just grown over the years. It's stayed with me all this time, and the silver pencil over the water was there. So, very strange. But to say, the significance of owls, interesting.
Well, yeah, and it makes you wonder whether something knows that in our culture, certainly here in the United Kingdom, and I think in America too, other places, the owl has a symbolism. You know, it's not only all-seeing, but it is also seen as mystical. You've only got to think about Harry Potter, the place of the owl in Harry Potter films. Going back to this case in 2011, we think, roughly, I'm just looking at a map of this area. Now, the place we're talking about is not far from Bridlington, but it's a lonely bit of coast. It intrigues me that these people had that experience, including the missing time, and decided to get in the car and go back there.
Absolutely, yeah. And, you know, I need to speak to this. I nearly said her name then. I need to speak to this lady again, because there'll be more information. I mean, when she reached out and told me about the account, I've got lots and lots of them. Not of this nature, but lots of different ones. And it takes a bit to get through them all. And I do want to reconnect, and because there's a possibility after talking about it that she might have spoken about it to a sister again, or even to a son, and there might be more information to be gleaned from this. And if you're looking at a map, if anybody wants to know, obviously you can look at Google and look at where Humanby is, but if you find the Spirit of Yorkshire, which is the whiskey distillery, that is the industrial estate, and that is the top industrial unit before you go down to where the guys back in the 1990s had their experiences, and that was the full spectrum of unexplained phenomena. I believe the Humanby case is potentially one of the best cases that's never been heard. I know I've spoken about it, but it's still relatively unknown. I devoted quite a bit of space to it in one of the Truth Proof books. I think it was Truth Proof 3. But, you know, you could write a book on it altogether. And the witnesses, Andrew and David, the witness number 3, I've spoken to, I've sat in his company, and I've got his account of what took place, but he's not willing to. I think I've kind of exhausted that avenue. He's given me what he's going to give me, which is fine. You know, and the people don't have to talk, but there's lots more to be spoken about with Andrew and David, and I will be doing that. That's going to be a priority, because I just want as much documented about Humanby, because there's a lot more about this case that I've not told. I've just got to be sure I can talk about this, because of the military involvement as well. This Humanby, and we know we've only touched on it, and there's lots of bits missed out here, people. So anyone listening to this who thinks, well, where's he going with this? I touched on it. because of the location, as we were talking about this ladies' encounter, and obviously there's another incredible case that took place there in the 90s, but there was military involvement. So it started almost poltergeist-type, peripheral-type phenomena, and grew as the awareness to the intelligence that is the phenomena grew. And it culminated in 1998 with a landed UFO at the back of the unit in Hunmanby. But not only did they have a landed UFO, the military were there. The military were there that night, and they knew it was going to happen.
That was the point about it, wasn't it? That was the thing we've remarked on so many times about this case. That they were either tipped off, they were part of it, they knew about it. There was something very, very strange about the fact that why would they turn up just as this was happening?
Yeah, I'm being careful for the witnesses, not being careful for me. They knew about it. That's all I will say. They knew about it in advance. And two of the guys in the unit had been told it was going to happen. They'd been told. But what we've got to understand is the men who worked there in the 1990s, they were just forging their way in life. They'd got young families and just making ends meet, paying bills, and they'd got day jobs. When they worked at... Excuse me. When they worked at the industrial unit in Hummanby, they went home, had their teas, and then drove the 6 to 8 miles from Bridlington to Hummanby to work in that unit, spraying high-end motor vehicles and fairground rides, sign writing and open-top buses. That's the kind of work they were doing. And they would work till 10 or 11 at night, then drive back to Bridlington and go to their day jobs the next day. On a weekend, sometimes they would work till 3 in the morning. So nobody except these men, because there was nobody else working in these hours, got to experience what was happening at Hummanby. And you know, there's the missing time element there as well. You know, told me that sometimes he would, and only on two or three occasions, and I were listening to the recording the other day because they allowed me to record them. He said that I would drive there after my tea some evenings. And it only happened two or three times, and I'd see a flash of white light. He said, and I remember seeing the flash of white light, and then all I remember is I'm driving home. He says, but you know you must have done something. You know you must have got there. You can't just drive somewhere and not have no memory of it. Mm. But that's what happened. And both men recall the flashes of white light and then this kind of void of what's just happened here. And I don't think that's unique to Eastern North Yorkshire, because Hummanby's just slipped over into North Yorkshire. You know, I'm sat here and I'm in East Yorkshire at the moment. I think there's common threads run through the full gamut of the unexplained, whether you're interested in the cryptids, the UFOs, spiritualism. There's a thread that runs through it all. If we look, we don't have to look hard even, and we can see the similarities, you know, the flashes of light, the light form phenomena associated with the cryptid sightings, the light form phenomena associated with spirit type apparitions and sightings. And I think far too often, and I'm sort of jumping about here, people, so apologies, but I think far too often researchers, and if that's what they are, because I think we're all researchers, your listeners, everybody, we're all looking for the answers. I think we're pigeonholing the bit of the phenomena, the genre that we like, and not jumping out of the box and saying, do you know, there's a connection here. There's a connection that on what date was it? 14th of November 2019, Paul Sinclair and Lee Haywood saw the huge sphere of light on the hillside at Bempton. And then during COVID, a few years later, he sat on the cliff tops and he meets a guy with witnesses, by the way, who claimed that he'd seen a cryptid type creature. And when you get the date, it's the 12th of November 2019. We know it's 2 days before, and we know there's years in between finding the information, but we're literally a mile and a half apart, and there's two completely opposite type encounters with the unexplained or experiences with the unexplained, but surely there's a link there. You know, I mean, that's how I look at it.
And that's the perturbing thing, isn't it? And we touched on it, I think, maybe in our last conversation here, maybe in the one before. But the idea that there is maybe something unified that is behind all of this, yeah. But it's something, it must be something that is going to stretch our, not only our credulity, but also stretch our minds. We may not be equipped to understand how there can be one all-embracing phenomenon that produces all of these effects. And are they effects that are external to us but project themselves into us? In other words, are they real, or are we seeing them because something is putting them in our heads? Or are they three-dimensional, solid, you know, like your Wolflands documentary, the people that think, you know, that experience stuff in the forests up to the north of you, you know, were they really experiencing those things? Were those things projecting into them? Was it a mix of the two? These are things that are perhaps at the moment beyond our ken.
They are beyond us. You're absolutely spot on, and there were loads of things there, Howard, that you were saying that kind of need addressing. And there's the one common factor that runs through it all is this descent into the lower silence, what some people would call the Oz factor. And that runs through all aspects of the unexplained. During a UFO sighting, people will claim that everything's gone quiet, everything's gone eerily silent. There's a guy on the clifftops at Scalby Mills near Scarborough who went up there to watch or try and observe the northern lights, and then suddenly he heard a branch snap. Now, the intelligence that is the phenomena, I believe, did that as a distraction for this man, because his mind suddenly was channeled into the darkness to where he'd heard the branch snap. But before he knew what was happening, it's almost like the magician showing you one hand when the magic is occurring in the other. Before he knew what had happened, he said everything had just enveloped into this strange lower silence. Well, that's the words I'm using for it. He said it's though somebody has flicked a switch. He said, and I couldn't hear the sea anymore. I couldn't hear anything, the seabirds. And we're in the night, people. So please be aware that these seagulls that have got eyes like owls, they fly all over the place. I live in a fishing town, and they don't switch off during the night time. He said, I couldn't hear anything. And he felt like static and prickly heat or type sensations all around him, and an immense fear. Now, we get that descent into the lower silence across the full board of the unexplained.
We do.
We have to, I may be wrong, but I don't think it's just targeting an individual. Or if it is, the science that is this phenomena, this exotic science, cannot just target the individual, because it's had an effect on everything around him. It's had an effect on the insect life, the bird life, or like you said 2 minutes ago, is it something that's projected into the individual and that nothing's changed? It's just the way that we're feeling because
our perception. And this is what makes me think, and sorry to jump in, that
there's
something that I've wanted to talk about on the show for a long time, but, you know, I'm not a scientist and I'm a guy who does, you know, journalism over the years and radio shows. But I'm fascinated by a state that we get ourselves into, which is almost trance-like, when we're nearly asleep but we're still awake. Things happen in that state. It is an altered perception that you have. And the reason that I say this in my own case is that I have, as people know, an ongoing problem with tinnitus, ringing in the ears. And, you know, I suffered a studio accident a few years ago where loud sound was put into my ears in a television studio, and my ears ring a lot now. But when I'm in that half awake and half asleep state, I am still aware of what is around me. But the ringing goes. It's like it's filtered out. It's like I'm somewhere else at that point. And that is the point at which, and I know other people have this experience, but I will see things. Now, I know this sounds like craziness, but I will see things, if you believe in these things, around the location of the third eye. The things that I see are, I've never really talked about this, I don't think, are displaced upwards of my vision, my two regular eyes. But I will see sometimes scenes of little villages or people moving around, or in one case many, many years ago when I was much younger, somebody who I actually knew, who my father employed when he ran a shopping centre in Liverpool, the Belvale Centre, the guy on the gate who later, it was just before this man died, and I think his name was Billy. And he was a nice man. He had a uniform and he was on the big gate with the barrier at this shopping centre that my dad, when he left the police, took over the running of in Liverpool. Those who are in Liverpool will know the Belvale shopping centre. It's still there. But I saw Billy. I saw Billy on the gate in his uniform and his peak cap. And it wasn't long before Billy died. And it was in that state. I've always been fascinated by, and I'm sorry for going on, by what happens to us. And whether we are perceiving things beyond us when we're in that state.
I actually think we are, and obviously I've never heard you speak about anything like that, but I've had similar experiences, and I've spoke to people in the past who've had similar experiences. And if anybody who's ever read Truth Proof 2 would look at the subtitle, it's called Beyond the Thinking Mind. And that's where I'm going. That's why, that's the essence of the subtitle, because strange things happen beyond the thinking mind. If you can switch off, and that state that you're talking about, Howard, I believe that state just before sleep, that sort of no man's land, is beyond the thinking mind, and that's when things infiltrate. I bet when you saw Billy, I bet it was just like looking at the clearest movie that you'd ever seen. Everything was clear and crisp, you know. And I've seen these kind of things myself, but most of the time, and we talk about it, you know, when we go on the cliff tops. And Ian will go up there. He has similar experiences. And you know, at the time, when these things are coming to me, I don't say it works this like this for everybody. If I try and identify what I'm looking at, because I'm seeing people I don't know, I can see cars on roads, and like you've just said, you see villages, and I don't know these locations. I don't know where I am, and obviously, I'm not there physically, but in my mind, I'm looking at it like it's a movie. And this might sound a bit crazy to some people, because I mean, I don't really talk about this often myself, but it does happen. And there are periods when it's prolific, and you might have a week, 2 weeks of going to bed and experiencing this kind of thing.
We've never talked about this before, Paul. We're both having the same experience. I've had it for years. And like you say, the places you've never seen before. And it's almost like you're standing back from sometimes slightly slow motion, but like you're standing back from a movie, but it's there. And you're thinking, where is that place? And I'm seeing a car. I once saw a few weeks ago, like a village with you know, those American style picket fences that they have on all the westerns, and that movie that's very popular at this time of year. It's a Wonderful Life. The places have picket. I saw like a village, but I don't think it looked like it was in America. And it was a place of picket fences. And it was almost like my mind was a drone. So I was taking off and doing the full panorama of it. This happens to me all the time. And I am convinced, and I'm sorry to my listener if this is getting boring for you. I promise we'll move on. But I am convinced that there is something, and we've never talked about this before.
Never. I'm surprised we are doing, because, it's not something I sort of cover in anything I'm talking about usually.
No, but I think, and I might try and do something on it on the radio show or somewhere, I think there is some worthwhile research to be done, if it hasn't been done, what that state means and where it is.
I'm not sure if it's astral travel or an out-of-body experience. I really don't know. And I know you want to get away from this in a moment, but do you find, and do any listeners who've experienced this, do you find that if you try to identify, say you're looking at people, and to me, the strangers, I don't see anybody I know, but they're as clear as day. As soon as I start to try and think, could that be so-and-so, or could that be that person, it closes in and goes. Yeah. I have to let my mind just be free and not use the thinking mind, if that makes sense.
When you start to be aware of it, it's going to go.
It goes. Yeah, it goes, it dissipates.
So we've both had the same thing, and there's probably somebody going to email me saying, that's well known, it was written about by Sigmund Freud. I'm just not aware of it.
It's all good.
And, you know, in one case in my life, it was about a real person who died very, very soon after I'd seen him, which I always thought was bizarre. I was probably 22 when that happened, if anybody wants to know. You're doing a couple of documentaries. I want to talk about those just to say that I did an experiment at the beginning of this, before the beginning of this. I put on Facebook that I was going to be doing this conversation now, recording this, and I wondered if anybody who happened to see that post, if he had a question for Paul, then, you know, I could put those questions to Paul, and I've got quite a few here, so we will get to those. But let's talk about After Wolflands, which I thought was incredibly well done. You sent me some footage from it.
Thank you.
The documentary about the strange happenings north of where you are in the forest. You're going to be doing a couple more documentaries.
Yeah, I'm doing another one with Les, who I did Wolflands with, and I do realise it took us 3 years, people. Let's hope this one isn't as long. And I'm doing another one with Chris Turner, where we did Bringing Down the Light, and people will know Chris for Elusive and Don't Mention the Reptilians. He'd done a few documentaries before doing anything with me. And yeah, we've got some incredible cases. There'll be slightly different types of documentaries because I were more hands-on with the editing and everything with Les, and Chris, I'll leave the editing to Chris Turner for the ones he's doing. But yeah, we've got some interesting and new information that we're covering in these documentaries, Howard.
One of them, I think, involves a shadow being.
Yeah, that's what me and Les are going to cover, because obviously Wolflands was very lonely cliff tops, into the forests, onto the moors. But amongst the research, other things started to sort of infiltrate more into suburbia. And we've got shadow type beings that we've talked about, and we've been in and interviewed the witnesses on ground zero, should we say, in the forests of North Yorkshire for the new film. But then I got one really strange one from this chap contacted me to say that his former partner, who he's still very good friends with, had an experience with what he called the Sandown Portman. He said it had a pointy hat and a cloak. It was shadowed, and he'd seen it, and he believed that this thing was some kind of attachment that had followed him from another place, because he'd seen it before over a number of years. And then when he got in the relationship with this lady who later became disabled, it carried on showing itself. He'd see it in a doorway. He said, I could walk through the doorway and I could feel it. I could feel the static as it was there. And he tried to keep it from her. He didn't want her to know. He didn't want to frighten her. And I think one day they'd been out somewhere, and he got her to a door with a wheelchair and what have you, and she got inside, and he said he was off to the shop. We'll say to get some milk. I really don't know what he'd gone to the shop for. When he came back, the lady's out of a wheelchair and on its side. The wheelchair's on its side, and she's in a bit of a state. And she claimed that a shadow of a huge being with a, we'll say a cloak, a hooded robe, but with a pointy hat, or what looked like it, had been spinning around in this chair and pushing her, absolutely terrified her. And that is the story, it kind of condensed, terrifying experience. And after that, and before, they were poltergeist type activity in the property. You know, because of the lady's disability, she'd got electronic blinds on her windows, and they would just open and close of their own accord. Now, some people could say, well, this is an electrical fault. And yeah, we've got to play with that idea. We can't throw that out of the window, pardon the pun. But so many things were happening in and around this property and around this lady and her partner, sort of culminating with this, what we would call this attack from this entity. So we've jumped into suburbia or we will be doing with, you know, with the new documentary. We'll be covering some of these terrifying type experiences. And you know, I think when somebody says, well, I don't believe it, and I'm sorry for saying it so bluntly, I can't blame you. You know, I don't blame people don't have to believe anything because Paul Sinclair's saying it, or Howard Hughes, or anyone else. But when you've got a collection of reports, and they're all strikingly similar, and they're all sort of fairly level-headed people, we've got to attach some kind of truth to some of them, if not all of them. Not everybody's a liar, but I can sympathise with people who say seeing is believing, because for many people, you would have to see it and experience it yourself before you could actually take it in and well, you wouldn't enjoy the experience, but know what the experience was like.
Well, seeing is believing, and there's another element to it. You have to have the courage, and in the Hunmanby case, it took those people, 11, 12 years to contact you about their missing time, etc. It takes, as the other element, a lot of courage to come forward and tell a stranger something that happened to them that maybe they hadn't wanted to discuss before.
Absolutely, and it is courage, and there's loads of things at play, because I have a report that I've received from November 2022, and I've changed the lady's name. I've called her Anna, and she doesn't know I'm going to talk about this, but she's not told me I can't, so I know it's okay. And she sent me the report, and we've kind of gone through this, and she was driving towards Flamborough Village in November the 3rd, 2022, so the day after my birthday, November the 2nd, I am. So there's very little traffic, and she knows the time was approximately 9:30 a.m., and it's nothing spectacular, but it's stuck in her mind. And she knows that because she said she was parked and out of a car at 9:45 in Flamborough Village. And as she's driving past the Lynx golf course, and this golf course is flagging up just like that hill. You know, at first it's the phenomena that's hidden in plain sight until you start to receive all the reports, and it may take years for them to sort of land in front of you, and then you start to think to yourself, hold on a minute, we've got a location of high strangeness within the zone of strangeness. And she's just passing in the car the Lynx golf course. And she said that she spotted on the golf course, just on the very edge of the golf course, a huge bird that looked like an eagle, but it was 4.5 foot tall. Now, we know, with the best will in the world, we know that eagles do not grow, probably not even 30-inch tall, never mind 36 or 48-inch tall.
Not round here, they don't.
I don't think anywhere in the world an eagle stands 4.5 foot tall, Howard, you know. Somebody could correct me, but I'm pretty sure they don't. But what struck her, she said, I was driving past and I slowed down. It was about 30 foot away. And she said, I'm familiar with wild birds. She said, I've seen the buzzards, which are the red kite, which is the largest kind of wild hawk that is around where she lives. And she's seen all these things, but this was much bigger, and it was standing upright. She said it had mottled brown colours, greyish white beak. Well, you know, if we talk about the sea eagle that's seen at Flamborough and around the cliff tops odd times, you know, probably frequents the area once every few years. They don't have a greyish white beak. You know, it sounds totally different. She said, but my response, that she's questioned her response. She said, I just thought, oh, it's only an eagle. She said, a moment later, I set off driving. And she can't believe that she did that. She said, because it had huge yellow eyes, and it made eye contact. She said it looked directly across at her, and her response was, oh, it's only an eagle. And then she said, when she got later on, when she's thinking about it, she's beside herself why she never thought to take a picture. And she believes there is more to the sighting of the eagle. She thinks it's some kind of screen memory. And as kind of thinking of the owls and the people that are seeing the owls, and is there a connection to this? Are we being shown something else? You touched on it earlier. Are some things projected into our minds? You know, I really don't know. I mean, and we're just throwing all these ideas about, but strange one. She could have just seen an eagle, that standard size sea eagle, and it's got all out of proportion in her mind. Of course she could, but she's quite adamant, and she's a very articulate, knowledgeable lady in her own profession and with wildlife. So I don't see how she's made that mistake. And then we're staying with the Lynx golf course, if time will allow, Howard. I don't know.
Yeah, no, we'll do this, and then I'll get to those questions are still coming in while you were talking. So we'll get to the questions after you've said this.
Right, yeah. I mean, it might take us 5 minutes, this, but the Lynx Golf Course, I received a report secondhand from a young man called Ben. I'm saying young man, he's young to me, isn't he, if he's in his 30s. And he told me that whilst working years ago, about 2007, he worked at the local supermarket, I think it was the Summerfield, that one of the managers or one of the higher-ranking staff stood outside one day with the younger guys, the ones who'd just left school, talking and just killing a bit of time. And he said, told him he'd seen a monster. He said, and we all sort of stopped. And this guy's really serious. And he's telling us that he'd finished work. We get to the first-hand conversation, by the way, Howard, because I don't like second-hand conversations. And he told him he'd finished work and he thought it was a few years before and they'd gone golfing onto the Lynx Golf Course driving range. So we're on the same golf course. Okay, so I'll do the story from the first-hand account. He couldn't remember the guy's name, and I obviously couldn't. I just knew this supermarket. So between myself and this witness, we did quite a lot of digging, and I found out where this man worked. And I spoke to him and put the question to him very, very politely and discreetly, because I didn't want to embarrass anybody, and it could have been somebody who just didn't want to talk about this anymore. And he asked me to leave an email address, which I did, and I thought I were never going to get any kind of reply. And about 3 weeks later, after I'd given up thinking I were going to get a reply, I get the story. And sure enough, it wasn't 2005, or even though he'd been told, you know, the worker at Summerfield had been told in 2007, he told me it was 2000 to 2002, and he'd finished work. He borrowed his dad's car, and himself and a friend went to the Lynx Golf Course to do some driving of the golf balls on the driving range. He described it as an oblong area of land with trees to the right and to the left and to the bottom, and boards all the way down, which would give an indication of how far they'd driven these golf balls. It's evening time. It's not quite dark, but it's late. It's, you know, winter's on, the oncome of winter. He said, and he noticed to the right-hand side a white figure in the trees. White. Oh, that's what he thought at first. He said, and he sort of stopped and fixed on it. And then he said it come out of the trees. He said, and it looked like marble, devoid of any hair, totally naked, devoid of anything distinguishing things that would make it human in any way, shape or form. No muscularity, pipe cleaner type arms, and those weren't his words, but from his description, that's what I'm seeing, and legs, there's just nothing there to say how it's supporting itself, and no eyes. He couldn't see eyes. It's about 100 yards away, and he couldn't see eyes, and this thing's moved slightly onto the golf course. He didn't know his friend had seen it at first, and obviously, moments later, his friend, and we won't swear, but he started with an F, and he said, what the is that? And he said it quietly. He said, and I didn't see it turn its head. I don't even know if it was facing us. He says, but I knew it had stopped, and it was looking at us. He said, and the fear that came over us both was overwhelming. He said, we packed our golf clubs away, got into Dad's car, and drove back home. Now, he sat on that story. He would have probably sat on that story forever, if not for the guy he told it to years before at the supermarket, who reached out to me and told it me, and between us both, we traced the man. So how many more accounts of the absolutely bizarre, Howard, are out there untold and are going to the grave with people? You know, it's such a shame. And once again, we've got an area within the zone of strangeness that's flagging up concentrated pockets of the unexplained.
Scariest thing about that story is that this creature appeared like marble. You're saying like the solid, you know, the solid thing that they carve stuff out of.
Yeah, absolutely. He looked absolutely smooth and like marble. He did say, but slightly grey. He said, like, it looked like the texture of marble, but slightly grey. Forgot to add that bit. And it's a really strange area, you know, and this is the area where we did our live stream the other night, and a lady called Joe, who lives close to Danes Dyke, but I'm not going to say where, has contacted me in well, she's kept in contact since hearing it. And I think in 2020, she made a conscious effort to contact me on the night of 2020 and said, there's some animal howling and screaming in the dike and making all sorts of unearthly noises. And that was the 16th of December, 2020. It happened again on the 16th of December, 2021. We don't know about 22, but it's interesting that I've got reports of the cryptid type creatures from October 2020. I can't remember the exact date in October. October 2021, all from that area, first-hand witness sightings. This lady only heard something. So once again, we have to keep our feet level and firm on the ground. It could have been people playing pranks and running through the trees, howling, but it disturbed her enough after she's lived there all those years to say this sounded different. And we do hear foxes sort of screaming and yowing in the night, and we do hear the roe deer when they're calling, but this was different. But, you know, it's one of them we're probably not going to know. And it's what drives me and what keeps me fascinated with the subject, Howard.
And as you said, on page 34 of Truth Proof 2, I'll refer back to it again, location is key, but also the witnesses and their credibility and the clarity of recollection is key. Let's get to some of these questions, and thank you very much for sending them in. This was just an experiment that I did about 10 minutes before I started recording with Paul. I posted on Facebook, if you happen to be about right now and you got any questions, and I was expecting to get a couple. I've got a hell of a lot more than a couple. So let's try and crack on with these as quickly as we can. Stuart says, I've got a really good friend who lives just off the beach in Filey. I know that you do, because we've talked about them. He asks, do you have any stories involving Filey? Maybe something recent, if you do.
Yeah, there is one by a guy, I don't think you mind me saying his name. He's got a scientific background, and he's Richard Appin. And he went to Filey this year. We walked from Filey towards Caton. That's correct. And he observed strange lights over the sea that he couldn't identify, not aircraft lights. Then I'm pretty sure that he'd seen them on the beach as well. You've just put me on the spot here, Howard, but we'd got that one. There's a report from a police officer, but it's not this year, who saw an object with his wife. And he was stood on Filey Brig, and he was looking towards Speeton in the evening time, but a clear summer evening, so it wasn't dark. A young couple behind them with children who witnessed it, and there's a UFO, typical, or UAP object just above the cliff tops at Speeton. But what's interesting, he said it came over in perfect zigzags across the sea towards them and stayed overhead. Anybody who says, was this a drone? It was totally silent. It was huge. His wife said it had columns and windows in it. Interestingly, this guy's a former police officer as well. He doesn't recall seeing windows. He saw columns. The couple behind, they turned around and after it had gone, because they're all mesmerized, and said, did you just see that? And they'd been watching it before him. They'd seen it before. And I can't remember the date, but they contacted the Scarborough Evening News and the Bridlington Free Press. I've never spoke to these people. I've seen the report, and, you know, it's a small world. But I actually got contacted then by the second witness. So yeah, lights beneath the sea, lights beneath the waves at Filey, what lights beneath the sea off Filey Brig, fishermen seeing strange lights while they're on the beach fishing. The former hairdresser at Filey many years ago with her husband saw an object. You can't drive along Filey Brig. So I need to just briefly describe Filey Brig. It's an outcrop of rock that runs out into the sea. And obviously at high tide, it's covered, and there's a light buoy at the end to prevent ships hitting these rocks. And it goes out for about a mile. You can't drive along it, but at low tide, they saw something moving along Filey Brig and just go into the water. She said they could see people inside it. You know, there's so many things around the area of Filey, Bridlington, Caton Bay. Seriously, Howard, could devote hours and hours to these locations.
I've got to say that I'm impressed that We didn't set this up. You didn't know these were coming. They're still coming.
Oh, I have no idea.
Still coming. I'm holding my phone in my hand. They're still coming in. John asks, says, I love, Paul, your stories and sightings of lights off the Yorkshire coast. Do you know of anything similar off East Anglia at all? And Paul says, one of my regular contributors, Paul, chimed in with a reply to that saying there have been some sightings in the Wivenhoe area. Now, you told me the last time we spoke that you were spreading your net beyond your own area. I don't know whether you've done East Anglia.
I haven't done East Anglia, and if you've anything to share, you know, I'd love to hear about it. I've so much information. No disrespect to the guy who's sent you this question, that I'd probably be more enthralled or interested to read about it and learn what you know, because I probably wouldn't be able to look into it, because I was telling Howard before this interview started that at the moment I'm just overwhelmed with information and things to follow up. But don't let that deter you. that feeling will pass.
And John, John, you know what you have to do. All right, let's crack on with these. Tom says, this is THOM, Tom. Tom says, any strange happenings in the Hornsey area lately? We saw the big fireball a couple of times out to sea, did you? Usually around midnight or the early hours of the morning.
How incredible. And I bet that was September, Tom. There were sightings September, all through September, but September 23rd to 27th this year. There's a lady who lives in a bungalow that looks straight out onto the sea, and we've been and interviewed her. She's seen the spheres of light, that have kind of exploded and gone into a multitude of even more lights. And we're not talking about a flare. These things have gone uphill as well. You know, and we spoke to this lady at length, and she's allowed us to film her. There's a James, they call this guy, and Angie's the lady who saw the lights. Unbelievably, he was on the beach fishing with another man, and there's all sorts of flashes of light out at sea, and he thought it was an electrical storm. We were on the cliff tops at Bempton whilst he was fishing at Hornsey, so we would be probably 17 miles away. I filmed the flashes of light, and I've actually got a ball of light. It could be electrical, it could be some ball lightning in this light. But there was no storm out at sea, and he then, during the process of looking at this light, looking at these flashes of light, observed from inland, coming inland and going over the sea, a red to orange sphere of light over the sea, which he's told us about and gone on film. There's a fisherman a little bit further down the coast, at Tunstall, so it's not that far, much further down, fishing on the beach. This is all in the same time frame. We're all in September here. We're all in September here, and this guy's fishing. He's come with his wife and his children. And whilst fishing, he observes a light, a big sphere of orange light, just descend from the heavens and stop over the sea. From that, it splits, and I don't want to say it splits into three, because, like I said, there's so much information filling my head. It could have been four, but it splits into several objects, which then turn green. And he said they were flying about like butterflies. This is his description. Whilst looking at this, amazed, the only person on the beach at Tunstall, a red light from inland, totally silent and low, comes over the top of him. It goes out to sea, and when he gave me the analogy, and we've spoke face to face, and this is another guy that myself and Les have filmed, he said it swooped down, and I kind of pictured the bouncing bombs in the Dambuster film. He said it swooped towards the sea, the red light, then before it hit the sea, it went back up again, and it merged with the lights that were doing this display over the sea, and they all went into one and became an orange light and went up the coast to Bridlington. Does this sound like something from a sci-fi movie, from Close Encounters? It's incredible. It does to me. And all of this were taking place. And whilst he's watching this light, other anglers, some in Hornsey, some further up the coast towards Hull, are phoning him and saying, can you see this? Are you looking at this? So we know there's other witnesses. One of them saying there's lights under the water that are coming towards the beach. Not spoke to that guy yet. I maybe never will. But he's getting all this information. But then what happens after this thing's departed and gone up the coast? An overwhelming fear comes over him, and he hastily packs his gear up. If anybody's seen the frame captures from the filming that myself and Les did on social media, on Facebook, you'll look at the size of this guy. He's huge, really nice, gentle giant. But you won't want to tangle with him. He said, the fear came over me, and I packed my gear up. He says, I knew where the caravan was, where we were staying. And he said, and there was a builder's, not a builder's van, a roadworks type van, very close to it, with the chevrons on the back. He says, I couldn't miss it. He said, but I ended up, for some reason, at the bottom of the site. I can't work it out. I've got to be fair here. He's not said, I've got missing time. He said, but I ended up, I don't know how, I ended up at the bottom of the site. And when I got back to the van, my wife, and I've spoke to his wife as well, said the energy that he brought into the caravan with him was incredible. And we sat up all night with the children talking about what he'd just seen and experienced. Answer your question, Howard,
Tom,
anything in Hornsey and the immediate area, yeah, it's been very active. We've filmed Lights Under the Sea also in that same time period.
Well, there you go, Tom. I think that's a pretty comprehensive answer. This is amazing. This is all, I've got to tell you, to my listener, this is all direct recall from Paul. He didn't know these questions were coming.
100% didn't know. 100%. Okay. You know.
Graham asks, and these questions are still coming up, are there any reports of sea monsters off the Yorkshire coast? We've talked about some.
How incredible. There's one from 1934 from Filey. A Coast Guard claimed he'd seen one. It was just before the famous Loch Ness one. So if I've got the date wrong, people, 1934 is where I think I am with it. But there's a famous one from Filey where he sees this creature on the beach with the head that looks like a horse. And he said, once again, flaming, illuminescent eyes. I find that one interesting. You will find reference to it. You might have to do quite a bit of digging to find it, but it's there, and it predates the famous Loch Ness one of that year. So he's not this not somebody just following suit and jumping on the bandwagon. Do you know? So I just pushed that one out. Then if we stay between Hornsey and a place called Attick, which is all just down the coast from me, and I can't remember the exact year. Something tells me it was 2019. This guy contacted me. He was on the I wish I could remember the name of the caravan site, but he's there anyway, near a place called, he was on Skirlington caravan site, and he's having a day on the beach with his, I think, his grandchildren. And I've got pictures of this, Howard. I must send you these pictures. He said, I'm sort of laid on the beach, looking at the sea, children are playing, there's another couple close to us, and this thing comes up out of the water, and he's got pictures of it. I have no idea what he's looking at. He said it looked like something with a head full of hair that went all the way down. It looks like a telegraph pole sticking up out of water covered in hair. It's really strange. If you picture a llama's head, does that make sense? Well, it probably doesn't, you know, because we've got this.
No, I'm seeing it.
And he said, I looked at it. It's about 30 foot away. And I'm going to meet the guy because he doesn't live in the area. I'm going to meet him, and I've already put it to him that would you consider telling us about this on film? And I think that this may happen. He said it submerged and then it appeared further up the coast. He says, and I've snapped a few pictures of it, which he's shown me, which I've got. Not he's shown me, I've got, and I don't mind sending them you, Howard. So is that a sea monster? I have no idea what we were looking at. I really don't know what it was.
Sure as hell sounds like one. I'm going to crack on with these because there are so many. Thank you to that for that, Graham. Okay, let's... No, I didn't expect this. This is very good. Okay, so we've dealt with that. Roberto. And a couple of people have asked this, Roberto and one other. I'm just trying to find your name here. I've literally got these on my phone, but, you know, Roberto's one of two people who asked, essentially, your scariest experience. I don't know whether you can encapsulate that because you know so much and you've done so much, but, you know, one thing that's maybe scared you more than anything else, if anything has.
There's lots of things scared me. I think we're all human, and to say that we're fearless would be a lie. The things in childhood terrified me to the point where I think I was 13 or 14 years old before I stopped wetting the bed. So there's an admission. You know, when you've seen things that you can't explain, you can't share with people, you've got a one of my parents who were quite heavy-handed, so I wouldn't have told him about any of this. So that were terrifying when you've realised that things outside of normal. I don't mean every night. I mean, it could have been once every 6 months. I don't know. You don't keep a diary. But when that happens in childhood, it's terrifying, if that's what you're meaning. And then on the cliff tops, probably about 4 or 5 years ago, maybe longer, I was with a guy called Steve Hatchbridge, one of my best friends from Hornsey. But we were on the cliffs at Bempton, and we were close to the back of Danes Dyke, which the north side, this 2.5 miles ancient Neolithic earthwork that cuts Flamborough Head off from the mainland, or that's what it were designed for 3,500 years ago, I believe. So, and I were up there, 11:30, 12:30 at night, and suddenly a fear overwhelmed me. We don't tell stories and jump in the dark and scream. You know, we're not the most serious people in the world, but that's not what we're about. We try to be pretty level, and there's just myself and Steve. And I said to Steve, I said, I feel frightened. He said, what do you mean? I said, I don't know. I said, everything feels static and bristly. I said, and I feel like there's eyes on me everywhere. And it doesn't happen. This does not happen with me. I go up there on my own. And he says, I don't think. I said, Steve, I said, we've got to go. I said, we've got to go. I said, I'm frightened. And so what did I see? I saw nothing. What did I experience? Extreme fear. Have I got an answer for it? No.
But boy, I mean, that is that feeling of being watched. There is nothing worse, especially if you're in a lonely spot. And you're not sure what's going on, which is what happened there. Gary asks, and this is an interesting question. Thank you, Gary. Because so much stuff happens around the cliffs at Bempton, we know this, and I've had listeners tell me regularly that because they've heard you on the show, they've gone up there to check it out for themselves. They've stayed near there. Gary is asking, do you think there would ever be a possibility of a live webcam feed from Bempton? Somebody do that.
Gary, I would love that. Do you know, Thornwick Bay, which would encompass Bempton, the camera would be high enough to catch this. There's a professional kind of street webcam on the cliff tops. I'll not say the name of the guy who owns it, but he owns the cafe at Thornwick Bay. I'm not saying reach out to him. I don't know how we'd do it. I've tried about at least 3 times. I've been and visited the cafe early in the morning, because his other job besides owning the cafe at Thornwick Bay is that he fits CCTV and other things. And so he's got this great big camera on the cliff tops that it just overlooks nothing, the sea, the cliffs. And it's a street type one, a really good one. And I've said, you know, I said, I think I could get you subscribers who would actually pay. I don't mean an extortionate amount of money, and no money for Paul Sinclair. I'm talking about you guys, myself included. I would pay a few pounds a week to be able to look at this camera 24/7. And as a collective of lots of people, I think it would be worthwhile, because apparently it's not doing anything at the moment, and which is such a shame because there's cabling to it and everything. I don't know what it was put there for, even by him. Obviously, somebody with an interest has asked for this camera to be put up. But I've tried at least 3 times, and I bumped into him probably 4 or 5 weeks ago and asked the same question. And he's not giving me a flat blank no, but he's always got a lot on at the moment, and you know, and it's eventually you feel like you're pestering someone, don't you? So, to answer your question, Gary, I'd love a camera up there 24/7, but where could we place it, and you know, and where how could we fund it? You know,
I mean, they're good questions, but look what that's done. It's a different example. But the Loch Ness Monster, there's a permanent camera, and the things that people see. I want to press on. Francis asked about time slips. I think we've covered that, Francis, with one of those experiences, but I know that you've got some. And I promise we will come back to the time slips, because I personally am fascinated by time slips. The stories are quite rare, and the number of experts to talk about them you can find are rarer still. Phil says he's got video footage of orbs interacting. Okay, does he have experiences with orbs and sightings of cryptids? And does he think the orbs interacting with cryptids may be something that is linked, says Phil?
I feel I 100% think it's linked. I don't know how, but I think we've got to accept the fact that there's some connection there when you've got people reporting seeing cryptid type creatures or even, I don't know, ghost type creatures and then seeing spheres of light. You know, the spiritualist or the ghost hunter would attribute that to spirit lights. I realize that, but I think we're all dealing with the same thing. So yeah, I do think there's a link, and the orbs interacting that you've seen, you know, some security guards up at Flamborough on one of the holiday camps observed them over the sea. I can't remember the date, but, 2014, 2015, and these things just switched on in a row, and they observed them, and they're looking at them, and they blinked off in sequence as well. And very often, it's almost like you're having some kind of interaction with these things. The police officer that went onto the cliff tops at Speeton, he parked at Bempton and ended up walking to Speeton, observed the sphere of light on the clifftop path, the really crimson or maroon type light that he saw with, like, he likened it to having a belt round the middle because it would seem to be pulled in. I called it the Speeton figure of eight because that's the kind of image he'd given me when he were talking about it. But he said he were feeling round in his pocket to get his phone to take a picture, and he couldn't quite get it, so he just took his eyes off this object, got his phone, and when he looked back, it had gone. Is there an intelligence that knows what we're thinking? Potentially, yeah. Fabulous. Great questions, people. Thank you.
They're incredible. I can't believe that I only did this before we came on, and I've got so many...
Have you done it before, Howard?
Never. I've never done it this way before. And I know that there are some podcasts out there, they do it in advance and they charge people for asking questions. I don't do that. I never have. That's not in the plan, but these things are still coming in. So we're going to have to crack on, you know, pretty smartish through these. I'm sorry about this, Paul.
Okay.
It's been more successful. I mean, it's saying something about you more than it's saying about me. You know, it's amazing. Jolinda, we'll do John in a second. Gren asks, did you ever get the answer to the scorched telegraph pole? I think you're going to have to remind people about that story.
Yeah, well, Gren may have the year in it, and I can't remember the year now. I think it might have been 2020. It might have been a bit later. But on a particular field, and it's the field where a lot of the sheep fatalities, should we say, the sheep deaths occurred, a telegraph pole exploded and... huge chunk blew out of it, all burnt, attributed to lightning, but the farmer was actually in his garage, probably 100 yards away from the telegraph pole. He said, we never heard anything. He just rang me to tell me all the power had gone. But what's interesting, further down the coast, and you've put me on the spot here, I can't remember the place, but there was a cyclist on a road along the coast road, and and there's a farm near the coast road as well. I don't know that farm as such, but he took pictures of a sphere of light, for want of a better word. Whether there's anything structured behind the light, I don't know. But he'd got a few grainy pictures of this light, and that came in, and it came. So he'd given me that report, and I've got a time for that report, and it was kind of minutes before, because the actual power outage could be timed. You know, everybody knew when it knocked the power off in Bempton, because it literally did. No, it knocked all power off to parts of the village. But, and this thing that had been seen a few miles further down the coast, and I'm saying a few miles, and we're probably going back 15 to 20 miles further down the coast, but on the same stretch of coast, had been seen. He'd got a timestamp on his photograph a few minutes before this electrical surge had hit this telegraph pole and blew it to bits, and literally blew it to bits. I've got a piece of it in my greenhouse about 8 foot from where I'm sat. Not what that means, I don't know. It probably means, how sad is Paul Sinclair? I took a piece of a telegraph pole.
That's quite a souvenir. That's a hell of a story, Paul. Ellie in East Sussex, thank you very much for a nice comment to me, Ellie. Thank you for doing this. This is literally something I've never tried live like this, and it's surprising. So that question was from Francis. Let's go to... I'm sorry, that question was from Gren. I'm losing.
I've got okay.
So many of them. There's somebody asking me for you to... Sebastian is asking for an estimate of the big cat population in the United Kingdom. I think that's probably more one for Rick Minter. But I think... What do you think, Paul? I would think it's in the hundreds.
Well, they're here. They're clearly here. I mean, and we know that. I mean, Rick will be able to tell you better than myself, but they cover a vast range of territory, do the cats. But I've been told on good authority from gamekeepers that there's at least two pair in the forests of North Yorkshire, you know, up around Harwood Dale and that area. And they're quite happy that they're there because they're keeping the local wildlife at bay, should we say. We know that there's some around Bempton. There's got to be two, I would think. We know that around Staxton Wold they're reported. Are they the same ones? It's only 11 miles away. I don't know. The description is slightly different. Plus, I've got different colours as well. We've got a beige one reported up around Staxton Wold. So, just in my area alone, I've had reports in this year and in the last two or three years of at least eight in different locations and different colours. And sizes, because some people, the ones that were seen near the Flamborough Lighthouse by an elderly couple who'd stopped just to observe the sea and maybe have a flask and a sandwich, a coffee, they watched this thing in a field where there were sheep moving between the gorse, quite close, you know, the gorse brushes, they were using that for cover. But they said it was only about marginally bigger than a spaniel dog. So this cat, although a big cat by anybody's standards, did not fit the description of a panther or a puma, should we say. So and then there's one at Staxton Wold that's been seen on the road from Fordon to where it cuts across to the main Staxton Wold road where you'd go to the hill. There's a pond there that's set back in the trees. I went and set cameras up and spent days up there years ago. Because it had been seen that much crossing the road near that pond. But the description of that was the size of a puma, but very long and almost, not emaciated, but very lean. It looked like it was struggling to forge an existence. But there you go. And there's one that's been... Sorry.
There's one that's been seen? No, you're saying?
No, there's one that's been seen close to the shooting ground at Staxton and by the workers at the Staxton sawmill, the timber mill. I contacted the timber mill years ago to ask them if they'd had any reports and they'd actually seen it coming down a field. So the reports are there. There's more than we think.
Got to remind our listener that Paul is doing this as I'm doing this on the fly. I ask for these questions and boy, thank you very much. Ethan in Canada. And I wonder if we can do this as briefly as we can. But Ethan in Canada, nice to know that you're there. Wolfman, dogman stories. Well, we know that in your area and in your research, you've got plenty.
Yeah, they're there, Ethan, and I'm pretty sure they're as prolific in Canada. Prolific, is that the word? Because obviously they're a bit...
Prolific.
Prolific, but they're a bit thin on the ground. But I wonder how many people are sat in silence. They've seen something truly terrifying. Our witnesses in Wolflands, you know, that we were very fortunate that everything, the stars aligned, and these people kind of came forward and told us their accounts. But you can understand if you've seen something of that nature, you can understand why you would sit on it and not share it with anyone. Not just the terrifying nature of it and the thought that I perhaps never would go into the dark again, but the fact that there's the saying, seeing is believing. And you talk about seeing a UFO and people are more likely to believe you nowadays because they know that the potential of these unknowns being out there. But you tell them that you've seen something with the description of a werewolf and they're just going to roll their eyes and think that you... Well, you're absolutely nuts. But
At the moment.
I think out of all the genres of the unexplained, the cryptid phenomena is the one that's the hardest to put over to people. And if my job is to keep pushing these first-hand witness accounts out and with as much detail and as much, truth in them as possible, then I'll continue to do it because I do believe that in most cases the witnesses are telling me the truth.
Lewis, thank you very much for your question and point. I'm not going to put this specifically to Paul because we've sort of covered it, but you're wanting very specific detail about these things. Loves the show, he's telling me, which is great. Thank you very much, Lewis. I mean, as you've heard, Paul can dig this stuff from the top of his head when he's put on the spot like this in a most impressive way. The other person who asked about your most challenging, scary experience, I guess, is Ian, so I hope we covered that. Ian, and another Ian Monteith, thank you for your kind comments about my recent issues. It's all a work in progress, Ian, thank you. Pete, In the late 80s, early 90s, I saw a triangle object following a commercial plane. In each corner of the triangle was a light as if it was following. It was spinning very slowly. South Coast, Sussex, wondering if other people have seen something like that. It was nighttime. Now, that kind of, it's not specifically that, but that reminds me of the Burling Gap story, which is very Sussex, that you told me about the guy who encountered something in a field that was very, very strange. So yeah, I think the answer is yes to Pete.
Without a doubt, and without going into the Burling Gap story, I mean, the guy who told me, Jason, lovely guy, he was in the area, but came through to and met me, and, you know, he relayed this story, and he's had all sorts of health problems ever since. But the triangle sightings, you know, they've never stopped, really, have they? You know, obviously the 1990s seemed to sort of hit the peak of the triangle sightings, but I don't think the triangle sightings have stopped. And the fact, did I pick up that you said it was spinning? The triangle was spinning. Is that correct?
Spinning slowly, according to this, spinning very slowly. South Coast, Sussex.
You know, I mean, obviously, I've not got a chance to speak to this man, but he doesn't think it were the lights that were turning, going on and off in sequence, and perhaps giving the impression that it was spinning.
Well,
and
he says that in each corner of the triangle was a light as it was following. It was spinning very slowly. So I'm not quite sure. Pete, listen, yeah. What I'd ask you to do, because Paul is always very diligent about this, if you don't mind, Paul, why doesn't Pete give you an email about that? And maybe
I would love him to. It's interesting.
It's a great story.
And I'll just briefly tell you my reasoning for that. North Yorkshire, 1990s, guy in a little village in North Yorkshire, looks out of his kitchen window and there's a disused quarry about 100 yards away, bottom of his garden, single track road at the bottom, and a quarry at the other side of the road, disused. And he sees I think it was an oval-shaped object over the quarry. Obviously not inside, but it's low enough. It's just over the quarry with lights on it. And as it began to move, it had a light on one corner and a light kind of offset. And as it moved away, it gave the impression that it was turning, but it was the lights that were turning. And then as it was flying, it looked like a zigzag in the sky. But he'd seen it close enough to realize that the object wasn't turning. It was something about the light configuration that was moving. And as it gathered speed, it just looked like a Z or a zigzag moving through the sky. And that then was reported over Humman, believe it or not, as well. Somebody had said they'd seen a zigzag-shaped object moving through the sky. And that, I just threw it into my head when you were talking about it turning. But obviously you saw that and I didn't. So, you know, you're probably spot on with your your assumption.
Now, I wasn't going to ask about this earlier because I didn't think we'd have time. But let's do it anyway, because it is so fascinating. The Willsthorpe UFO incident. I mean, this was an comparatively recent and all singing, all dancing case. David asked Paul about any new developments over Willsthorpe, any new research that you know about. It's an important UFO case, black triangles going into the sea, the military sealing off the beach. I mean, this case, as we've discussed on previous editions of this show, had it all. But is there anything new that you're hearing about Willsthorpe?
Well, Willsthorpe's still throwing up unexplained reports of the unexplained. Last year, just off the beach, very close to where the elderly couple witnessed the UFOs over the sea, I had a report that came from a Coast Guard to me of a triangle going into the sea, all lit up. And without going into too much detail, I put a Freedom of Information request in and asked for, I'd got everything. I'd got the time, I'd got everything. And they told, the request came back saying they'd got no reports of it. So you make of that what you will. Are things still happening at Willsthorpe? There's a farm close to Willsthorpe, and I've got information from the farmer. This is the same guy who found the crop circle. There's so many things here. When he was driving his combined harvester and when he drove through the crop circle, his spaniel dog that were laid in the cab of the circle just sat bolt upright and began to howl. The temperature inside the cab of the combine suddenly went cold. He explained he'd no air conditioning. I know we're jumping all over the place, but once again, we've got a place that's a zone within the zone. There's a lady called Carly, who in November of 2009, because the Willsthorpe, what we call the Willsthorpe incident, Cool Mill, to me, kind of climaxed on, in September. September the 15th, 2009, with the UFOs over the beach. But I thought that was the end of it. And then Carly's contacted me, and she was travelling home with a work colleague. I think they'd come from Hull. They're driving down the road that parallels Fraysthorpe and Willsthorpe, and there's a hedgerow running down the side of the road and fields then, just farmland, leading to the flats at Willsthorpe and the beach. And there's a car in front of them, the red saloon car that's weaving all over the road, and they believe he's drunk or he's ill or he's used drugs, with they don't know which. And so it suddenly just pulls in on the skew in front of them, and she slowly starts to pull around it, and her passenger is screaming hysterically in the car, absolutely beside herself, and she thinks it's to do with this car. And prior to that, she'd started screaming just before it stopped. And then when she starts to pull around the car that stopped, and Carly's gone on film, she's allowed me to film her with the full account. She said, I looked to my right and there's a huge object literally paralleling us at the other side of the edge. It had a big red light on one end and a red light on the other. She said, I couldn't see the top of it. It was huge, monstrous-sized thing that was silent. And we're only looking at the other side of the road and then the verge and the hedge. So she's literally 40 foot away from this thing. And a work colleague screaming her head off hysterically. She carries on driving down the road, can't believe what she's looking at. When they get to the roundabout at Willsthorpe, November 2009, she said this thing stopped and sped out to sea. It had gone in an instant. So here's me when I wrote about Willsthorpe, thinking everything had simmered down and stopped in September 2009. Things were still happening in November. So, yeah, there's more to be found at Willsthorpe. And anybody listening to this who's remotely interested or may have any information relating to it, please get in touch.
And I saw a photograph before we started recording this of the principal witnesses, the elderly couple in the apartments. They're like retirement apartments, aren't they, at Willsthorpe?
That's correct, yeah.
They're the least likely people, I would have thought, to, you know, report something like this or for something like this to happen to, which makes, in my mind, them even more credible. Kerry gets in touch. Kerry says that that Wolflands was fantastic, and just wants to praise you for that and say your interviews are superb, which they are, Kerry. You're dead right. And Kerry, I mean, Paul's interviews, not to forget mine.
Howard, it's you that pulls this out of the people. And I know you've stressed several times that we didn't know we were going to ask these questions. And I honestly didn't, but I don't mind. I'm enjoying this.
Well, this was an experiment. I'm glad you were up for it. And thank you so much to my audience, because here's proof that you're there, that you would see these questions, this posting going up on a Friday morning and respond. And I gave them a 1 hour time slot, and all of these questions came in within that hour. Kerry also asks, and we have touched on this, these areas of high strangeness that we've been talking about, do they coincide, is the nub of Kerry's question, with ley lines?
They may do. I haven't got a great knowledge of ley lines, Kerry, but they may do, if is the closest I could give you to an answer. It's interesting that, you know, the Rudston monolith, so you'll probably be familiar with that, you know, the tallest standing stone in the UK, probably 29 feet high. But if you look at maps and you get a map, an ordnance survey map with the burial mounds on, the famous burial mound that produces events of high strangeness, Willie Howe in Wald Newton, that run a ruler through it, and then it will go towards Sharp Howe, the Barrow Cemetery at the top of Staxton Wold, and you know the Staxton Wold radar base. They all run towards these locations of strangeness. You know, Staxton Wold radar base has had its fair share of UFO sightings above and around the base over decades and decades. I've said it before, but this is the oldest operational radar base in the world. You know, and then if you look at the old RAF Bempton, which is on the edge of the North Sea here, 3 miles away from where I'm sat now, you run a line through that. I'm not saying these are ley lines, Kerry, but run a line through that and you'll go to a base at Speeton, which is still operational, which is only about 3 miles away. Continue that line and it goes to Staxton Wold. continue that line, and I'm not going to say it does, but so some of your listeners might want to look at this for me, because I was only thinking about it the other day. I think it might go to GCHQ. I think that will go in a continuous line. I mean, it could be just perfect for radio communications and radar type installations. Probably the reason, but I find it fascinating, especially looking at the Rudston monolith, that it actually just about crosses the burial mound of Willie Howe, and the reports from that burial mound, they go back to the 12th century, with William of Newburgh recounting the man who passed the burial mound in the early hours of the morning on his horse and seeing a hole inside the mound all lit, and his recall is that there's a vast banquet going off with hobs and goblins. In today's terminology, we might say that there's some kind of alien visitation taking place and some kind of abduction. I don't know. It's all interpretation, but it's fascinating that these locations, they don't just... It's not me. I'm not. All I'm doing is telling them in present day, but there's been people there decades, hundreds of years before me, saying similar things, just with a different way of saying them.
Colin, thank you very much for your kind comment that's just come in. James, nice to hear from you. Stephen also asked about the scariest thing that we did cover. Thank you for that, Stephen. Where shall I go? We'll do two more, and then I think we're going to have to do it, because we're going to break some records for durations of podcasts, which is great. Tyneside. John is asking whether you've had reports from Tyneside, whether you're looking into reports from Tyneside, which is north of you.
Yeah, I've had reports from right up the coast, not quite as far, obviously, at Skinning Grove, cryptid-type reports. And there is a report from up there, and the guy who told me, Phil, and his cousin, Kev, I'm trying to think of the name of the book. They wrote a fictional book about Filingdales, and we'll get to what he told me, but I think it's called The Meadow Project. Interesting book. The Black Meadow. Yeah, and I think it's been on radio and things. It might be interesting for you to talk to these guys at some point, Howard. They're really interesting. But Phil did receive a report of a... And they're not UFO investigators, by the way, people, but he were out, and he'd been told by a father and son that they'd seen like a window or an opening in the sky. And it was terrifying, because apparently somebody went through it. Somebody was sucked through this window or opening in the sky. Now, I'm going to cut it there as regards this one, because I'm venturing onto the second-hand information type case, and in all instances I like to talk about first-hand information, and I'm sure if I give my head a really good scratch I could think of more and things that I've heard from up that way, but that's about stumped me at the moment.
Okay, well, no, that's really good, and I think we're going to have to park it there, but thank you very much for all of the questions, everyone. I'm going to end with this one. And Stuart, thank you for this. I think you've done me proud when I set you a target, a test like that. You know, you, Paul, have been amazing. My listeners have been superb for responding so quickly. I've never tried that before.
I can't believe it, to be honest with you. You know,
we might give that a go again. But, I mean, if you go to my Facebook page, you will see exactly how it unfolded, Paul, how I asked people, and then they just started sending me questions.
You might not want to say it times, Howard. If you do, you do. If you don't, you don't. But you did tell me that you'd put this on and you'd received a lot of questions. And we'd had a natter prior to going on air, but not covered any of this. I'm absolutely amazed.
No, well, I'm amazed and stunned at your ability and your recall. Let's leave it with this one from Stuart then. Stuart says, could you ask Paul what esoteric subject or subjects you would like to look into but haven't got round to it yet?
Oh, gosh, God, what an hard question.
Well, life after death, maybe.
I'm interested in... I don't suppose, Stuart, these are subjects, but I'm interested in the links between all of the phenomena. And it'd be great... Not necessarily... I don't know if you could write a book about it, but to have the ghost researcher and the UFO researcher to come with their strongest accounts of light form phenomena, of this descent into the lower silence, and try and paint a picture for everybody who's not thought too deep about it, and as you can see, I haven't got an handle on this, just how many similarities there are within all the genres of the phenomena. And let's, instead of pigeonholing what we're interested in, I mean, it still might be your strongest interest, still might be UFOs, but think outside of the box a little
exactly.
bit.
Exactly. I was just about to say, think a little bit outside and take a... So there's an awful lot of stuff out there. Paul?
Yeah, and apologies, Stuart, for not really answering your question fully, but
I think you did. And Stuart, thank you very much. And thank you to everybody who absolutely stunned me that, like, 5 or 10 minutes before I started to record this, I put a posting on Facebook and just said, you know, any questions for Paul Sinclair, thinking I'd maybe get 2 or 3. We've been stunned by that. And your recall, Paul, amazing. Hey, listen, I wish you the happiest of Christmases and the greatest of New Year's. It's likely we won't talk before 2024. But, you know, good luck in all that you do, Paul. You deserve all the success that's come to you. I'm very proud of you. And take care. Thank you.
Howard, thank you, and thank you to the listeners.
Wow. You did me proud with those questions. Thank you very much to Paul. What amazing recall. It's all in his head. So much research. I recommend those Truth Proof books and the Wolflands documentary. Paul's a good guy, and he's been a good friend to me, and I'm so pleased that I did the first interview with him a few years ago, and look at how well it's all gone for him. That's great. Ah, more great guests in the pipeline here at the Home of the Unexplained. So until we meet again, my name is Howard Hughes. This has been The Unexplained. And whatever you do, please stay safe. Please stay calm. And please stay in touch. Thank you very much. Take care. Bye-bye.